So I need to begin my sermon by asking you to ignore the title which I gave the sermon several days before I actually wrote it. This, by the way, is something I do every week, and for the most part, it's fine. I think of a title for my sermons by guessing what my unwritten sermon will be about, and because I know myself relatively well, my guess is usually close enough, but this week, my ideas about the sermon changed significantly between the time I came up with the title and when I actually sat down to write the sermon, which was after the bulletin had already been printed. This, by the way, is why, until I came here 6 months ago, I never gave a title to a sermon, and why titles may disappear in the very near future. You never know. The reason I had a problem giving a title to this sermon on this morning's lesson from Matthew is this. I really like at least three different ideas about what this passage might mean. And I've preached on the story enough times over 20 years of preaching to have a pretty good idea of how to articulate what is solid and what is somewhat flimsy about all three of the interpretations I like. None is entirely satisfactory to me, but all of them have their good points. And as I was getting ready to write the sermon, I went back and forth and back again on which of the messages I should bring you from this passage of Scripture. And I settled eventually on this. I'll present all three interpretations to you, and you can figure it out. The first interpretation of the story that I like is one that idealizes childhood and says that we must be like children to enter the kingdom of heaven because children are playful. They have active imaginations. They can fight like dogs and go back to being fast friends with admirable quickness. Children have faith that enables them to believe in magic, in Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, and in their own royalty. Even children who have nothing will find ordinary objects and turn them into toys, much in the same way that the adult church finds bread and wine and turns them into the body and blood of Christ. A child knows he needs the help and comfort of the adults in his life. This interpretation relies on a somewhat overly sentimental view of childhood that I tend to associate with the Victorian era. It is expressed in the writings of my favorite Victorian authors, Robert Louis Stevenson and J.M. Barrie. And it's an opinion shared by Friedrich Schleiermacher, the father of liberal Protestantism, who wrote about this passage by saying, "The peculiar essence of the child is that he is altogether in the moment. The past disappears for him, and of the future he knows nothing. Each moment exists only for itself. And this accounts for the blessedness of a soul content in innocence." That's lovely, right? But the idea that Jesus is calling us to be like sweet little children has its problems. And if you doubt me, I've got four words for you. Lord of the flies. I gave up on the sentimental exaltation of childhood interpretation of this story about 2 weeks into my first summer working at a summer camp. For all the ways kids can be cute and adorable, they can also be mean to each other. They don't always understand that things like racist or homophobic taunts are hurtful, nor are they always good at sharing and listening. I'm not talking about your kids, by the way, or mine. Naturally, these are the other kids, kids who go to camp, kids who can't stop shooting milk out of their straws, or worse, out of their noses, kids who go absolutely bonkers on the strength of a single jelly bean's worth of high fructose corn syrup, kids who insist on giving each other wedgies, even when you're strumming your guitar, trying to lead them in a nice, calming, spiritually poignant moment of kumbaya. I'm not sure Jesus wants us to be like those kids. Prior to the 19th and 20th century sentimentalization of childhood, John Calvin interpreted this passage by pointing out that children are the most humble members of society. And this is the second interpretation of the story that I'm going to lift up for you, the one that I was going to use back when I gave my sermon a title. If we assume that Jesus calls us to be like children and to welcome children because they are the most humble members of society, then that has some serious implications around what our faith should look like. If Jesus wants us to be like children and to welcome the least powerful, and if these powerless humans are the stuff out of which the kingdom of heaven is made, then in this passage, Jesus is challenging the idea that human ambition should be about gaining power and gathering wealth and seeking privilege. This is important stuff, especially in a capitalist society where we are judged by social status and by the swag and bling that decorates our lives but that exacerbates our worries and concerns. In this interpretation of the story, we are called to take sides, hence the title of the sermon. Are we going to be on the side of the rich and the powerful, the empire and its military-industrial complex and its financial system based on exploitation and greed? Or are we going to be on the side of the poor, the marginalized, the oppressed, and the sore beset? Will we be like children, seeking to be humble and being intentional around expressing our solidarity with those who are humble but not by choice? I think that's a pretty solid interpretation, and I'd never discourage your use of it. But here's where I find it to be problematic. It turns the childhood recommended by Jesus into an abstraction. And most churches need reminding that real children need to be welcomed and cared for, not just in the developing world or in our nation's rougher neighborhoods, but right here. This is how my mother interprets the story, and I suspect her insights are at least as solid as those of Calvin and Schleiermacher. The idea that we need to welcome children and be like children is an idea that most congregations need to hear as they interact with their own children. And in my last congregation, as wonderful as that church was, the first conflict I had, the first test of my pastoral leadership, had to do with cookies. Apparently, at coffee hour after worship, some kids were eating so many cookies that from time to time the adults didn't get cookies. And so some members of the session wanted to institute a no cookie for kids policy. I found myself quoting my mother at these people. And the last conflict I faced in that congregation had to do with the fact that one of the ushers was saying unkind, unwelcoming things to families with fussy babies. And once more, I invoked my poor mother, who to this day has no idea as her opinions have been used to settle arguments in Silicon Valley. One of the things I truly love about this congregation is that you don't have a problem welcoming children. I have yet to hear anyone complain about kids eating too many cookies. And you are so comfortable with children in worship that you created a space for them by taking out a pew and putting down a rug where they can crawl around and read books and play together. You guys are wonderful. But if you change, hear me now, I will quote my mother at you. I will make sure you understand that having children in church to steal cookies and to fuss during the prayers, this is a really good problem to have. You know, the chief cookie thief from my former congregation is now, in my opinion, one of the finest young pastors in the Presbyterian Church USA. And how good for all of us that the church had cookies for him to steal. And in my opinion, the congregation that doesn't hear the cries of a fussing baby as the soundtrack of a hopeful future, this is a congregation that needs to work on the health of its soul. But the trouble with the idea that this story is meant to direct the hospitality we show to the very real children in our midst is that we can't overdo it. Sometimes churches get so wrapped up in catering to the needs of children that those congregations become painful places for those who are infertile or those who have lost children or those who for whatever reason don't have or cannot have or wish they had children. In all things, there must be balance. So there you have it. Three valid, if imperfect, ways to read and to understand the passage. But which is the right reading? When I started working on this sermon, the first thing I did was to read Calvin's take on the passage, because John Calvin's life was filled with children. John Calvin, of course, is the grandfather of our Presbyterian tradition. He only had one biological child, and that child died in infancy. Soon afterwards, Calvin's wife also died, and he never remarried, but Calvin had stepchildren from his wife's first marriage. He raised his stepchildren, and they kept living with him after they got married and had children of their own. Calvin's brother also lived in the house with his children and grandchildren. And this was before the invention of the church office. Calvin worked out of his house. A biographer of John Calvin once noted that if Calvin in his writing seems to come across as a grouch, it's because so much of his writing was done to the sound of teething children. So I figured Calvin's perspective would be helpful, and in writing about this passage, Calvin noted his own interpretation, which I mentioned earlier, and he said that his own interpretation of the story was imperfect. And he said that no interpretation of the story need be too closely or too exactly carried out so that it applies to all points. And that, I think, is a good place to end. You see, the best stories have multiple meanings. The best stories are layered, and nowhere is this more true than in the stories that children read. Take, for example, fairy tales. As adults, we like to pick them apart. A Jungian psychologist may find one message and say Snow White, and a feminist theorist may find another. A cultural anthropologist will have a separate opinion, while artists like Stephen Sondheim will incorporate and use elements of fairy tales when they're creating great works like Into the Woods. And it's all good. It's all correct. But when children read the story of Snow White, it's much less complicated. A child just reads the story. A child hears a story about a beautiful maiden who's betrayed by her jealous stepmother, saved by a huntsman and some wonderful forest-dwelling dwarves. The wicked stepmother catches up with her and puts her into a death-like sleep until she's awakened by love's first kiss, and they all live happily ever after. It is a story with many meanings, many understandings, and the child who reads the story will take and make use of whichever interpretation is helpful for her as she grows into adulthood. If she needs help understanding how the realization of the masculine and the feminine sides of her psyche will make her whole, she will read Snow White as a Jungian. If she needs language that will help her articulate the ways in which women's agency is diminished in Western culture, she will read and reject Snow White as a feminist. If she's looking for clues about how pre-Christian paganism endures in Western culture, she'll read the work of anthropologists. And if she needs great material for a story or an opera or a painting, she will read Snow White as an artist. My recommendation is that we read this morning's gospel lesson, and in fact, the whole Bible, in the same way. Read it as a child. Just read the story as a child would, and then allow it to speak to your life in whatever way works. If you need to remember the joys of childhood, if you need to allow God's Spirit to pull you out of the stress of life in the 21st century, if you need to remember how to play, how to believe, how to laugh, how to forgive, then read this story as Schleiermacher did. If you need language with which to talk about how God calls you and all of us to side with the least powerful, most vulnerable people in the world, then read this passage as John Calvin did. And if you ever find yourself tempted to resent the child who takes too many cookies during family hour, then read this like my mother reads it and beware. But remember, your life will change. At various times, you will need this passage to say different things to you. So don't cling too tightly to one particular interpretation. Keep reading it as a child. And as you grow, the story will change for you. I know that sounds like magic. But remember, you're supposed to be like a child. You're supposed to believe in magic. Amen.